Previously on Popping Collars.
For whatever reason, the Hollywood set decoration department, I don't know who's in charge of how computer screens look in movies, but whoever's in charge of that keeps on giving us computers that in no way look like computers. There's kind of these, like, you know, the green screen full of code, and when you break into the tower, there's this, like, three-dimensional map that shows up. This has nothing to do with anything. It's
characters hammering furiously on the keys as they're trying to figure
out. Right. Yeah, right. And perhaps running to the wall to pull the server apart or that like the, you know, Anonymous takes over.
And the intro goes something like this. Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture. I'm your host. My name is Greg Knight. I am in Palm Beach, Florida. No co-host this time. Instead, we have a panel full of special guests. First, from down here with me in Palm Beach as well, Burl Salmon. Welcome, Burl.
Thank you so much.
From Macon, Georgia, it's Ben Wells. Hello, Ben.
Thank you, Greg.
And finally, back with us again from San Francisco, California, Eric Matoye. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Thank you, Greg. Good to see everybody.
This is episode 43 of the 1,189th ranked podcast in the iTunes spirituality category, and our topic today is 6 Feet Under. Created by Alan Ball, this is an HBO series from the early 2000s that takes a darkly comical look, sometimes, at members of a California family who run their own independent funeral home. It's a character-rich drama, as we learn more and more about the Fisher family and what makes them tick. So I'm curious, is there one member of the family or character on the show that stood out to you in particular, and why did you find them compelling? Burl, do you want to kick it off for us?
Sure. I'm glad to. I just watched part of the last episode because I needed to brush back up on it, and it's just so incredible. And my affinity went immediately back to David. It's David with whom I identify. It's David who wrestles with his sexuality throughout the entire several seasons that the show was. And then finally, in the very last episode, it's David who confronts his demons that he needs to confront and overcomes them in a really beautiful transformation.
Yeah, I think the struggle with David that's really amazing is how left out he feels, mm-hmm. I think, even though he was so closely tied to his father's work and worked alongside his father, there's some distance there between he and the rest of his family that he has to reconcile over the course of the show.
Yeah, and he feels like all of it is on his shoulders. And he feels this burden that he didn't ask for. And what to watch that is to watch the experience of him trying to figure out what really he is supposed to do, what he should or shouldn't do, and what makes him should or shouldn't do. What are his obligations and what are really his not obligations, which he spends a lot of time trying to figure out what he's really not obligated to and then what he should be doing.
David stepped into, you know, just assumed a role of the child who is going to take care of everything. I keep thinking of, you know, Rabbi Friedman's view of family dynamics, and he just sort of stepped into that role of, I'll be the one, you know, literally the middle child that's going to take care of everything, and all the triangulation and mm-hmm. all the dysfunction of my family, you know, this is my job. I was thinking, you know, I always lean toward a split between Keith and Nate. Nate, because I recognize from my own wandering days what it's like to sort of, I'm going to leave the family behind, and oh, wow, now I need to grow up.
Oh, crap, I don't have any money.
That's right. And yes, bagging groceries in Seattle is probably pretty close to selling pencils on Harvard Square. It's a nice place to have a muck job, but after a while, you kind of need health care. But the way that he struggles with trying to do what he feels is innately the right thing, and yet still be not only coming back into a family that he left behind, but also into this business world that is so different from that has even more responsibilities in some ways than running the biggest health food co-op in Seattle.
What about you, Ben? Who do you remember from the show?
Yeah, it has been a while. I honestly remember the apparition of the dad connecting with that character, and the way I took when their dad appeared was trying to lead them in a direction, or at least get them to reflect, you know, a chance for them to use what they've learned in their life so far.
And Nate would be the character that I probably identified with the most, but I gotta say, it's Ruth that I find to be the most compelling. There are some scenes on that show that ring really familiar to someone that grew up in a house full of boys, which is sort of taking moms for granted, I think. And there's something about those kitchen scenes.
Yep.
Where the kids will just come in and just treat the kitchen like, oh, well, there's supposed to be fresh fruit on the table here, or there's supposed to be, you know, something that mom's made in the refrigerator and stuff. And there's this, so many of those scenes kind of happen that, you know, there's got to be something that's being pointed out here, something about the role that Ruth is playing to these children as provider, but also something about how she's being looked over by her children in these scenes as well. And then as soon as she starts saying something about how she feels, everybody looks at her like she's an idiot. You know, there's something that rings very familiar. Sure. About moms and kitchens and, you know, absolutely, not understanding where your mom is coming from. And stuff.
Absolutely.
Like, I'm so glad we ended up in this place of family systems, because I had never thought that this would be something that we would actually go into. And I don't know why I was just so blind to it. But, you know, what I remember from Pastoral is that, like, family systems would always come up whenever you were sort of talking about marriage. But this is such good work for the end of life stuff, too. Because these roles that you sort of embody all of a sudden start to come out in unique ways. Well, I'm the older child, so I need to now be a provider, even though I have no earthly idea what it is that I'm doing, you know, and it's actually my younger brother that does, and that becomes a source of conflict. Like, how many conflicts can kind of come out of these dynamics, all because you're trying to fill, like, this role that you feel like has been designated to you?
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot. You know, it's no secret that funerals or burials can bring out the best and bring out the worst in people, and generally within those family dynamics.
Because it's a battle for control, or what?
Possibly some of that. Some of it's just a battle to fill the void.
Right. I think you may be right. I think a lot of it is completely unintentional. Some of it's probably intentional. But when we are faced with crisis, and we see this happening as clergy people, I see it in two places. I see it in weddings, and I see it in funerals, mm-hmm, which are the two places that are dearest to us as human beings, because we're dealing with love, we're dealing with family structure and changes to that structure. They're also societal pressures that go with both of those things. And so when all the craziness starts happening around death and funerals, a lot of it is a reversion to childhood roles.
Absolutely.
That we do without thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden we're grown up, and so we're adding our grown-up baggage onto a train car that's full of baggage from when we were children, and so things get kind of wonky. But a lot of that, I think, is a reversion to a role that we were psychologically a part of as young children, and then add on to that societal expectations that either exist or don't exist, or you perceive exist, and then you have a recipe for some really craziness at both of those times in families' lives.
This weirdness aspect, I think, is totally right. There's something about end of life that you're in this state of just numbness, blindness, weird grief stuff, whatever it is that you're working through grief-wise. And then all of a sudden, the funeral home experience becomes this really bizarre thing where you're talking about, okay, well, I've got to buy this kind of casket before I can get them cremated, and then I've got to buy this kind of urn, and then, like, what's the plot that they're going to go into in the columbarium, or, you know, whatever. It's just this it's this mind-boggling kind of set, and if especially if it's a sudden death and you're not expecting it, it just becomes this really weird scenario.
Yeah, and the way that the show, especially as we talked about, you know, the wayward son comes home. There's the prodigal son. He comes home from hustling granola and natural fruit drinks to being part of this industry of death, and he becomes the counselor. And I just kind of wonder, what would Fisher have sons been if it was all up to a David Fisher? Because Nate, because Rico, they're the ones who seem to have that, when things got a little touchy, they're the ones who talk that would be able to talk about the pastoral side, which as clergy, as members of the clergy, we do. But we have to come in as the comforters, and yet we still need to go through, now, which hymns would you like?
Yeah.
And would that be right one or right two?
Right.
But also, and I always tried to impress this, was this is a time where where we are expected to grieve. Don't stiff upper lip this part. And yes, there is that business part of, well, now we need to pick out the hymns, but I would even say, well, we can come back to the hymns a little bit later. We've got time. But it really was that. And I was very attentive watching those scenes at Fisher and Sons, seeing how they went through that, because in some ways they've got this business, and it's a family business, and especially having gone through series one and series two, that in the first series, the father dies, and there's this, you know, the big multinational was going to take over them, and how they were going to focus on being the family-oriented place, and still, they were selling caskets and they're selling plots. And just as you said, there's all this business part. But with the addition of Nate, there became a little bit of, okay, we can take a break now. Yeah. We can take a break now, and then we'll go back and look for the titanium casket that you can then spray paint in the matching colors of his motorcycle.
There's a human aspect to all of this business that right. we're doing. Yeah.
I mean, it's actually all over the place. If the parent has been, you know, involved in church and their child hasn't, I think that's when it becomes when two worlds collide right there in my office when we're trying to determine how to do the burial. And most of the time they just say, you pick the hymns because I don't know what they liked. I never went to church with them. But part of this is grieving. Part of it is remembering, putting it all together again.
I really appreciate that. Thank you, because it is trying to remember. For all y'all, how many have been dealing with people who actually had some pre-plans filed away somewhere?
I do.
I've had a few.
Okay.
I have a few.
Okay.
I beg people to do this, and I guess people just don't want to talk about it.
It's terrifying. It's so scary. So this is my number one fear in life is death. Like, just the idea that you don't see anything anymore. Like, I just can't, like, I can't fathom the loss of existence.
Or you see everything.
Right. Well, yeah, but you have to have, like, some kind of amazing faith. And I think that's the thing. Like, my doubt will sometimes like drive that fear to where it's like, I would just rather not even anticipate that it'll happen. And there's something comforting about pushing it away that way, I think, for a lot of people, which kind of drives them towards not making decisions about end of life care and stuff like that.
But we are all going to face.
Yeah, no.
Now I've had some people say, I won't really care because I'm not going to know what's going on. I don't care what kind of hymns I have, so I'm not filling out your form.
You just choose one.
And then I have other people, you know, a few, that say, this is how I want it. This is how I want this hymn done here. Mm-hmm. And it's just like life. I mean, you know, it's just part of how people react to things. I actually had a parishioner die today.
Oh my God!
I went and gave the administration of at time of death yesterday. He had his wife call me, telling me he was dying, and so I went over yesterday or last night And we said, you know, everything together. We said the Lord's Prayer together. He took communion. You know, he was physically in distress, but he was mm-hmm. certainly aware of what was going on. There is a part of death, I think, but can be beautiful.
Oh, I completely agree.
And I think even though physically he wasn't in peace, I think mentally he was wrapping his everything with a bow and getting ready to setting it down, his little pack beside him, and getting ready to leave the world. And that was the pretty part. So, and then he died this afternoon. So, right. And he wasn't. It was his wife was actually my parishioner. He rarely came to church, but he had her call me yesterday and tell me he was dying and wanted to talk with me.
Oh, that's
so. We did, and there's just some peace there to that. I mean, I realize not all deaths are peaceful. I certainly understand that, but I've seen some peaceful ones, and I'm sure you all have too. And it's it can be amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's actually where this show really helps me because I do have this fear of death and I do see it as just a negative. And there's something about the way that the show opens with a death every right. single time. There's something about the repetition of seeing people die, and sometimes it's sad and sometimes it's horrible and sometimes it's funny yeah. and sometimes it's, you know, it's just like life. Any of these things can happen. But there's something about the care that Rico especially has for the bodies that mm-hmm. are sort of entrusted to him, and he wants to make them as beautiful as possible. Like, that's his only – he's an artist.
Yes.
It just so happens that his canvas is bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he takes it as personal affront if you get cremated, because he can't be an artist then. Like, you're just going to burn his artwork, right?
Right.
And so there's something about that care – that especially Rico and David show for the people that end up in the home, you know, it's that you just want someone to care.
Part of Rico, I think, could be in us as priests. I want that burial service. I want it to be beautiful and meaningful for those people that are there. I follow our prayer book, and I've had so many people that aren't Episcopalians that come up to him and say, that was one of the most beautiful services I've ever seen.
I think you're exactly right that as priests, you know, I grew up in the American South, just like two of you guys. Eric, are you Southern as well?
I'm from Vermont.
Oh, bless you. You got so
not Southern.
So the three of us grew up in a world.
Southern Vermont.
The three of us grew up in a world where there were different kinds of funerals, and an Episcopal funeral is very different from what most people experience in the American South. Yep. And there is a beauty and there's a grace that I find so lovely in that liturgy, which is hopeful, and it is resurrection centric, and it is real. It acknowledges pain and grief. But in the midst of it, it focuses on that resurrection. And I think it's absolutely beautiful and grace-filled, which has been what you're hearing from people when they come to the funerals, which is one of the things I love to be able to do as a priest, is to offer for some moment that instance of grace, of God, of peace, and of hope for a resurrection. And I love that part of my job. I think it's a holy, holy time for me, and I love it.
Exactly. And this is what we do best. I think as Episcopalians, as Anglicans, this is our tradition at its best, that we have that moment of the divine in the liturgy where, as someone who is in the congregation, they can be as active or as passive, but they're still part of all that is happening. And I think it's such a beautifully dignified way to enter that transition into something new. And because it is a resurrection story, we can approach it that way, yet still with that point, still, you know, recognizing there is grief, there is sadness, but there's also joy.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I also want to touch on something else, and we talked about this, but this is actually my
my master's thesis was about death, and I looked at the way that Americans deal with death. And there was a great shift after World War II, actually, in the way that Americans dealt with death. And we no longer died at home. We died in institutions. Our burial practices changed. Our cemeteries changed. We no longer had in come these flat grave markers that you can mow over. Gone are the sort of individual monuments. And one of the things that we did as a culture was that we sterilized death. And we took it out of our everyday experience. So one of the cool things with 6 Feet Under beginning every single time with a death is that we got to be a part of that again. And it's something that we as a culture don't get to do. We see violence on television. We see death. We read about it. But we never just see the average person anymore. We never are that close to death. And certainly we aren't close to death in a home like the Fishers lived in. People were being embalmed downstairs.
Right.
So that made it very real for people. It made it difficult for some people. But for me, it was really wonderful because you got to be around death, which is a very natural part of life. It is as natural as birth is. And there's a really wonderful sort of fluidity to the way death comes.
When I have a parishioner that dies at home, I think I consider that a little victory.
Yep. Uh-huh.
For them.
Yep.
This parishioner that just died at home, you know, and I consider that a good thing. I understand that there are some people that the care is just, they can't do it at home. Sure. I certainly understand that. But there is something missing when we are taken out of our homes and then put in a sterilized, clean area with machines.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just something there to me. It's quite right.
Mm-hmm.
It's desperation. It's fear. It's all of that stuff that, you know, that you were talking about, Burl, that, you know, this idea that death is this natural part, right? Death is part of being alive.
Yeah, it is.
Is that death is part of it. And yet it's that piece of our brain that wants to sort of self-perpetuate and keep going. That's going, triggered survival mode. And it's like, well, if this machine is what's going to keep me, from facing that fear of whatever that is, which is basically unknowing.
Right.
Then I'll opt for the machine.
I think our culture pushes us to that also in our health system to, you know, keep alive at all costs.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I could go many different places with that, but I won't. Mm-hmm. And it's just, and I think the church has given up a part. How many church? You know, as I was explaining to a family 2 weeks ago when we did. The memorial service had been held, but they weren't ready to inter the ashes. So, you know, the committal is a very short part of the service.
When you have your funeral service, do you and you have cremains, do you walk straight into the garden after?
We do, yes.
Yeah.
What we do, we can, and that's my suggestion. But what it comes down to most of the time is that all the family member, when we don't do that, it's because many times it's because all the family members aren't there and they want to hold this one little part when certain other members can be there.
Right.
And
it's like wrapping your arms around the world most of the time. You're never, you can never get everybody
right.
together and in the way that you need it to be. Yeah.
So right. spread out. And,
And, you know, I'm going to a family funeral tomorrow, actually, and there will be a body. And the body will lie in state in the nave, and the funeral will be with the body present. And then they will take the body and cremate it with the inurnment for immediate family only at a later date, which is an interesting way of
mm-hmm.
accommodating both sort of family needs and larger community needs of people. You know, a number of people that wanted to say goodbye. So
right.
So they planned it both ways.
everyone was quite correct. The show is so rich in some ways to go, and I'm sorry I didn't write in my notes who said it, but the way that they just, it just, death. Death in oh so many ways, death in oh so many reactions to death, that it really was how, and I kept always testing myself, how would I respond in each of those situations? Seeing how the Fishers were responding as a business, but also now with Nate and Rico as also being almost grief counselors, serving in that capacity of their family business. How do I react as a member of the clergy of walking into that situation?
That's such a great idea for a pastoral care class, to show like one of the deaths. Yeah. Could you imagine if you get like the woman that got hit by a car because she thought the rapture was
happening? Oh my God, yes.
That episode.
That was great.
I remember two that really stuck out for me. One was the woman that stuck her head through the moon roof.
The moon roof.
Yes.
Scene. Yeah. Oh,
but the one that really stayed with me, because I used to do it, was the guy that backed out of his driveway and would lean out of his door and pick up his newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I quit doing that after I saw that episode.
That's when you got the E! News, right?
That's right.
Okay, so you're feeling all alone. I heard it on the radio. In a broadcast from the skies. And someday, I'm gonna rock the boat. And I'm gonna
You can do that too. So I'm just going to start with how you are on my screen. So Eric, where are you? What are you doing? And how can people get in touch with you?
Thanks, Greg. So you can find me at www.dialcal.org. I work for the Episcopal Diocese of California here in San Francisco. We cover the five counties of the San Francisco Bay Area. And come out west, check us out, and we are waiting for you, because we are the Episcopal Church in California. All are welcome and all are beloved in our little world.
Burl, where are you? What are you doing? And how can people find you on the World Wide Web?
People can find me at bbts.org, and that stands for Bethesda by the Sea. And I am in Palm Beach, Florida, with your host, Greg Knight. And we are doing amazing things on the shores of the Atlantic, so come check us out either in person or on the web.
Ben, where are you? What are you doing? How can people find you?
I am at St. Francis Episcopal Church in Macon, Georgia. It's www.stfrancismacon.org.
They still use the www's in Macon.
That's right. It is.
My name is Greg Knight. Okay. My name is Greg Knight. I'm the director of Children and Youth Ministries at the aforementioned Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida, where I work with Burl. You can find us again on the web at bbts.org. You can find me on Twitter at @ThatGregKnight. You can find Popping Collars on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/poppingcollars. And you can find us at our website, poppingcollarspodcast.com, where you can find each and every one of our episodes. Our most recent episodes are available wherever you get your podcasts, whether that be iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud. All we ask is that you subscribe, rate, and review our show. That'll help us move up in the rankings and help people find us. We are also featured on EpiscopalCafe.com each and every time. We love EpiscopalCafe.com. We know you will as well. Check them out for all your Episcopal news needs and beyond. And with that, that is Popping Collars for this time. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Burl. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you
for coming
Greg.
On the show.
Thank you.
Keep those collars popped, and we'll see you next time.